We have other issues here.
We're going to open the Senate Education Committee today, May 9th, just 5 days after May 4th, 2017. And with that, we are going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2013. We'll have a short explanation, and you are certainly welcome to come up to this event and bring anybody you want with you. Okay.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, House Bill 2013 expands eligibility requirements for lead preschool teachers under the preschool program administered by the Early Learning Division. It eliminates the requirement that lead preschool teachers have plans to attain bachelor's degrees and permits lead preschool teachers to have at least a bachelor's degree in a field not related to early childhood education if the teacher has completed coursework equivalent to a major in early childhood education and has sufficient training in early childhood education. It permits lead preschool teachers to have associate's degrees with additional training or certification in early childhood education or a field related to early childhood education. Permits lead preschool teachers to have alternative credentials to indicate that the teacher is highly trained. The bill also authorizes the Early Learning Council to adopt rules, requires ELC to develop lead preschool teacher target salary guidelines, and authorizes ELC to develop strategies to increase the mean salary for preschool staff. The bill directs ELC to conduct evaluations on accessibility and quality. The bill requires the Early Learning Division to determine how compensation contributes to a stable and qualified workforce, directs ELD to provide guidelines and technical assistance programs to address salary disparities among preschool teachers and staff, requires ELD to provide progress reports by February 1st, 2018, and a final report by October 15th, 2018. Declares emergency effective on passage.
Thank you.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Thank you for having me. I'm Tina Kotek, State Rep, House District 44 and North and Northeast Portland, and Speaker of the House. It's good to see you. Thank you for the excellent summary of House Bill 2013. We've made good strides over the last several biennia in the state around early childhood education. House Bill 2013 is a bit of a fix-it bill with the purpose of a little bit of a course correction, but also moving us forward on the area of professional development and salary expectations for early childhood educators. Back in 15, we passed House Bill 3380, the Oregon Preschool Promise Program, that we have been funding in several pilots around the state to make more access to high-quality preschool. And one of the requirements in that bill back in 15 when we passed it was that the lead teacher would have to have a bachelor's degree. That was a requirement for participation in the Preschool Promise. What we have learned since implementation is that has created a barrier for some child care programs to participate, not because people wouldn't necessarily want to be there. The reality is we have a lot of really great early childhood educators who don't have bachelors. They have many more years of experience, maybe an AA, or they have just very significant experience and certification through other professional development means, but don't have a BA. But with that strict requirement, it was creating some barriers to participation. I think the long-term goal of making sure we can improve professional development early childhood educators is really the goal. Some of that has to do with what we're able to pay people. And so what you see in this bill is an adjustment of the education requirements around the lead teacher and preschool promise and a study that says we have to really take a further stance on the salary and professional development discussion here in the state led by the Early Learning Division. So I think the summary did a great job. I mean, I could certainly go more detail, but it's a pretty straightforward bill and would urge your support. If you have any questions, happy to answer them.
So any questions?
It's amazing. She must have some pull to be able to get her bill scheduled in committees, I would think. But
only in the House.
Only in the House.
Mr. Chair, Senator Cruz, it's just because the chair and I go way back.
That's true.
We do
go way back.
It's a House thing. So
any further questions? I the conversation around equal pay reminds me even more about this issue, because when it comes to early childhood, most of the people have gotten to early childhood through their own hard work and working with kids and getting that little job that didn't pay much and being able to and work at it. And so I think this is the right thing to do. I would hope that at some point we actually start talking about paying, because as you know, the Preschool Promise pays better than the Head start, and all of a sudden we have these people moving from one to the other, and it makes it hard. And we want one system that works for all of our kids, and we have to continue to figure out how do we get funding for all kids to get it, and then make sure that it's a really good program. So I appreciate the bill. I appreciate the work that's gone into it, and the understanding that we don't always learn through academic institutions and bachelor's degrees. We oftentimes learn a lot through our life's experience and opportunities that were given to us to learn more about early childhood. And I know that those early childhood parents that come in and get trained as parents to become workers in those programs change a lot because of that knowledge that they get. So I appreciate that.
Really true, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your comments. I mean, I don't know who's set up to testify today, but on the House side, we heard from very high-quality preschool programs who wanted to be part of it, and coordinators of those programs actually having to hire someone with a bachelor's to be part of the preschool. Right. You know, so it's like that doesn't make sense. And the other point that we should all be aware of is we heard a lot of feedback from communities of color in that you might have some very high-quality early childhood providers who are more in tune with certain communities but didn't necessarily have bachelors. And so we were creating also some barriers to serving different communities as well. So this is, you know, this is a work in progress, and the study, I think, will really be helpful, too, for the long-term discussion. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And I see no other questions. So
thank you.
Enjoy your day.
Appreciate the time. Thanks.
Yep. So with that, we'll go with Danielle Specifico Colvin. And Andrea Salinas and Chris Vogel. It's really hard for me to have panels this time because there isn't anybody that signed up to be against it. So if there's anybody out there that wants to come up and have an opportunity, let me know. I'm not seeing any. So whoever wants to start first.
Sure, I'll start. Good afternoon. Thank you for having me. My name is Danielle Pacifico Kogan. I am the Communications Director and Community Engagement Director for the Children's Institute in Portland. And I'm here today to make a few brief comments in support of HB 2013. This is by no means a silver bullet to address the ethnic and language and diversity needs for the preschool lead teacher, but at the same time, this is a good start. Because we have places specifically like in rural Oregon, in eastern Oregon, central and southern Oregon, where we don't have enough teachers to meet the needs for preschools right now. So we know that this is just the beginning, and we're hopeful that the early educators professional development funding proposed in the governor's budget and enabled by SB 182 will create real opportunities for professional development that will help all of the children in Oregon, no matter where they live, and no matter what their language needs are, or their needs are in terms of access to high-quality early education. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Andrea Salinas. I'm the contract lobbyist for Oregon AFSCME Council 75. We represent AFSCME Locals 132, Local 2619, Local 3536, the non-teaching staff at the Oregon Child Development Coalition in Klamath County. The changes provided in HB 2013 are simple yet critical in continuing the conversations around providing access to quality preschool for children at all income levels in the state, as well as continuing the conversations around raising the wages of our early learning and child care workforce. In-home providers participating in Preschool Promise will tell you that a quality program doesn't need to have a teacher with a formal degree. Community-based trainings are often more affordable and accessible to these providers and are far more effective in giving them practical skills in creating curriculum than their formal education. The changes in HB 2013 recognize this and allow for the different paths of professional development a child care and preschool provider may take. HB 2013 allows for more flexibility around the lead teacher pay by providing for guidelines that will allow for the entire location staff to be considered and not only one classroom at a location. For those represented by a labor contract, Preschool Promise, as it was implemented, was pretty problematic. Head Start teachers, and all employees really, haven't received pay raises that have kept pace with inflation. Many could qualify for Head Start and other public services themselves. So when Preschool Promise rolled out, we had Head Start locations that became part of the program and had one classroom where the lead teacher would be making more than the teachers in other classrooms. The only difference was the funding stream. this was more than the lead teachers, or this was not equal pay for equal work, and contractually, this is a problem. Even for locations that do not have a union-represented workforce, executive directors recognize that paying one teacher for the same job others had been doing for years would cause significant morale issues. We must look for ways to raise the wages of all staff in Head Start and early learning. AFSCME representatives have mentioned in other committee hearings and numerous forums that meeting the needs of our early learning and childcare workforce, and as you just mentioned, Senator Roblin, the demand for their services will take a much more significant investment than what we currently achieve in the state. Until we fund early learning and childcare comparable to our kindergarten through college systems, affordability for families and low pay for providers will continue to be an issue. But ultimately, to make these kinds of investments, we do need additional revenue. AFSCME urges your support of HB 2013.
Good afternoon, Chair Roblin, members of the committee. I'm Chris Vogel with the League of Women Voters. The League began to study early learning on a formal basis in about 2012, rolled out a study in 2015 talking about the changes in structure within the state of Oregon. We continue to follow the development of the hubs and year-round follow the Early Learning Council as well as what's taking place at the state and the hub level and at the local level. And my testimony today is to commend that early learning community and to commend you as legislators for understanding that it's going to take a little bit more time and we need the flexibility to continue to get it right. We're working towards the maturity of this early learning system, and thank you for considering this bill that helps to fine-tune that.
Any questions for this panel? Thank you very much. Autumn David. And if there's anybody else out there that is jumping at a chance to testify in front of our committee, we would love to have you come now because there's some more chairs up here. But if not, Autumn gets to have it all to herself.
Dear Chair Roblin and members of the committee, my name is Autumn David. I'm with Local 132 Child Care Providers Together. I'm the president for the Child Care Union, and I'm a certified family child care provider in Salem. I've been in business for 20 years. I have 12 preschool promise children. I'm a step 10 on the Oregon Registry, and our program is a 5-star on the Spark. First, I want to thank you for helping make preschool promise a reality. I've seen firsthand how this is benefiting our community and the children that would be able to participate in that would not be able to participate in preschool. When I was selected to be a preschool promise provider, I was honored. I have built my program from ground up over the last 20 years. I am proud of the program we have. When preschool promise was very first starting, I attended the meetings and it was brought up that the qualifications for the lead teacher would have to have a bachelor's degree. I advocated against this. I knew I would not be allowed to be my own lead teacher in my own program. Oregon has built a system called the Oregon Registry for providers to show the step they are on. I'm a step 10, which I have always been told is equivalent to a bachelor's degree in the child care field. With the requirements of having a bachelor's degree, I have hired a lead teacher to be able to fulfill this requirement. Accepting to participate in preschool promise, I have thought hard if it's worth my time and effort to go back to school for bachelor's. At this time in my life, I do not think it's a wise choice. There's no funding for further education. There's no replacement of time this would take away from my husband, children, and now grandchildren. Would the time be worth taking away from my child care program I have worked so hard to build? We work long hours preparing, prepping, cleaning beyond our 13-hour days. I have to think what benefit this would really give me. I cannot think of any way this would benefit my program. I agree high standards are important, and I think the system of the Oregon Registry could work in guiding the requirements for this. I ask that you feel free to visit my program and see how having a degree would benefit me at this time in our journey. I'm not opposed to having a bachelor's degree. My son's in his master's program at ASU. My daughter's in Chemeketa. But at this time, it wouldn't benefit my program. So I ask you to consider the changes the bill would make.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
And thanks for committing your life to early childhood.
You're welcome.
Any questions? I think we're done. There is no one else on our list, so we're going to close the public hearing on 2013, and we're going to open a public hearing on 3313. So, Representative Barnhart, come on up, and we'll hear a short explanation of your bill.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, House Bill 3313 allows public charter schools to give priority admissions to students who reside within the service boundaries of non-chartered public schools that closed not more than 2 years before the charter school began to operate. The Dash 4 amendment allows that to happen if the following conditions are met. The school district that closed the non-chartered public school is the sponsor of the public charter school. The public charter school is physically located within the attendance boundaries of the closed school, and the school district board approved the public charter school giving priority to students of the closed school.
Which bill?
3313.
Oh, this is wrong. Mike scared me to death. Okay, we're good. It's the right bill.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Phil Barnhart. I'm the state representative from House District 11. This bill originally came to my attention several years ago, and let me give you a little history of the issue. I think it only applies to two charter schools in Oregon. One of them in my district is in the small city of Cobourg. Cobourg is just north of Eugene. Cobourg has been a part of the Eugene 4J School District for a number of years and was merged into the 4J School District because it's small and it was not able to operate on its own. For many years, the Cobourg Community School was operated by the Eugene 4J School District, and it had an attendance area that was essentially the city of Cobourg and the immediately surrounding area. At some point, a number of years ago now, I can't tell you exactly when, 8-10 years ago, the school district decided to close the public school in Cobourg for essentially fiscal reasons and move the students to a larger school in the city of Eugene to the south. The result of that was that the people in Cobourg decided that they would like to start their own charter school, the purpose of which was primarily to allow the continuation of the school that they had had in their small community. The school being, of course, one of the centers of the small cities in Oregon, and Cobourg is no exception. They did that. But because of the charter school law that we have, the requirements, which I'm sure the committee is very familiar with, require attendance, application for attendance to be open to a much larger group of people in the larger district and beyond. They have had to apply for waivers from the Department of Education for a number of years in order to concentrate on students who actually live in Cobourg. And it still is the case that some Cobourg students are unable to get into the school because of the requirement that they also give priority to students who live outside the old Cobourg attendance area and the old Cobourg school district. The same thing is true in Savvy Island, the old Savvy Island school. I don't know how many of you are familiar with Savvy Island. I visited there quite serendipitously with my wife. We were driving around that area one day and decided to drive in. It's basically a farming community. I think mostly EFU land. The dwellings and buildings are around the edge of the island. And there's one access, a bridge. It takes you over the river into the island and then driving around and then back out the same way. It's a beautiful spot. And my impression is, and certainly confirmed by the chair of the House Education Committee, who has worked there at some time in her work history, that its desires, when the regular public school was closed and a charter school was established, were essentially the same as the school in Cobourg. So I brought the bill. It did very well in the committee and in the House, and came over. There was one group of people who were opposed to the bill the way it was drafted, and we have I've prepared a set of amendments, the Dash 4 amendments, to essentially tighten up the requirements. I'm obviously not paranoid enough, because the original bill failed to deal with the issues that are contained in the amendment. That the charter school is chartered by the school district that closed the non-chartered school. In other words, by the district in which the non-chartered school existed, and that the charter school also is physically located inside the old attendance area. Representative Hernandez raised the issue with me one of the possibilities was that an outside charter could be formed by someone who received a charter from outside the school district, and it could cause problems with the school district's attendance plans and the way in which it was trying to set up a variety of other issues that it was dealing with, including discrimination issues and attendance of minority groups and that kind of thing. I believe that we have found an amendment with these additional requirements that the Dash 4 requires that I believe satisfies everybody and allows us to go forward. What this bill really does is it gives greater control to the local school district over this waiver process. It puts them in charge of it instead of having the Department of Education in charge of it. I think it gives a great deal of comfort to these two small schools that they will be able to have the children who live in the old attendance area have the first choice to attend these charter schools, which after all was the point of them going to the effort of establishing them in the first place. Charter schools are established for many different purposes. This is an unusual one, given that there are only two of them in the state, and I would ask the committee to pass it on to the Senate with a due pass and for the Senate to send it back to the House for concurrence.
Okay. Any questions for Representative Barnhart? Seeing none, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So we're going to open at the same time, because we have another representative here, we need to get him off to work. House Bill 2219. And so we'll hear from Representative Wisnett, and then we'll go back and get the people who are waiting for the other one. So, Representative Wisnett, thank you for being here.
Thank you for doing that, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and honorable committee members, for the record, I'm Gene Wisnett, State Representative, House District 53. I'm proud to bring you House Bill 2219A engrossed, relating to a subject I've worked on for many years. The bill came out of the House Education Committee and the floor unanimously. House Bill 2219 encourages school districts and public charter schools to offer students courses or other educational opportunities in civics. For many sessions, I've tried unsuccessfully to add one half unit of civics as a high school graduation requirement, as the chair knows it used to be required. I have had support from Duncan Wise on the State Board of Education. We've added civics as an essential learning skill, which a student must demonstrate to graduate. If you look in the bill, it's Section 1, Paragraph 1BA, says this list of essential skill levels, including civics. You heard a bill from our staff member last week about financial literacy. They would not put financial literacy in there, but civics is in there. The amendment did change the requirement directive to encourage, so it's not an unfunded mandate. I have many articles, and I could quote you or talk about it all day, about the need for importance of civics education. I'll limit it to a couple of statements by retired Supreme Justice Sandra O'Connor. She stated that 2/3 of Americans could not name a single Supreme Court justice, and that learning about citizenship is just as important for American children as learning math or how to write your name. I will tell you that recently my office received a call from a constituent asking me to be sure and not vote for Jeff Sessions for Attorney General. So we do have a problem with citizens knowledge throughout. Honorable colleagues, my hope is the bill will continue to encourage our educators to put more importance on civics education. I ask for your yes vote and move this bill.
Any questions?
The House doesn't vote on confirmations. So.
That's right. That's why he didn't have a chance. Okay. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, if I could, I have two bills that you heard last week in their work session today.
Yep.
If you or the committee had questions, I'm going back to education, House education.
Thank you. We do.
Higher education.
Any questions on any of the bills? I don't hear any of them have questions.
It was House Bill 2219 and 2220. One was the financial literacy, I believe, and the other one is giving diplomas yeah, to
2229 and yep
220
and 220 yeah
no questions thank you very much
yep
appreciate it.
There's one person on that bill, so we might as well finish up 2219. So Chris Volk, you're getting to be a regular at the up here testifying.
I'm Chris Vogel. I'm with the League of Women Voters. You would think that the League of Women Voters would be a strong advocate for civic education, as would all of you. You're elected representatives of the people. You want the people to understand what that process is all about. But today, I'm here to say that although we do support civics education, this particular legislative session, funding concerns for schools is overwhelming. That something that would be very nice to do at other times. When we're asking schools to cut teachers, we're asking classroom sizes to get larger, even though this bill has been modified so that it is no longer a mandate. Several different bills earlier in the session looked at a graduation requirement, a test that was required. The way this one is written, it's just that schools should offer something to students who are interested in civics education. That something will still take teachers, and it will pull teachers away from other sections, other parts of the school curriculum. So that's of concern to us at this particular time. I'd also like to point out that the Oregon Department of Education already has content standards, and these are course standards for grade levels from kindergarten through 12th grade. You can click on the link in my testimony and see what those are. Also point out that the League of Women Voters is very active, offering volunteer training to schools that want it, both on mock elections and civics education. And the Classroom Law Project currently contracts with the Oregon Department of Education for more civics education. So this looks like a nice rubber stamp bill at this point to say we value civics education. I'm just looking at how this will impact school districts whenever they're also at the same time getting notices that will require pink slips if we don't do something to stabilize revenue.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Okay, thank you. So we're going to close our public hearing on House Bill 2219. We're going to reopen. Well, it's already open. So we'll just call up Leah Claypool, Darla, is it Musin? I'm not sure. A few consonants in places that make it hard for me. And Richard Donovan. Whoever wants to start first.
I can start. Everybody's looking at me. Okay. I'm Richard Donovan on behalf of the Oregon School Boards Association. It was us. We were the people who testified against this bill on the other side that Representative Barnhart alluded to. So we had concerns with the introduced measure, and we brought to the Representative Barnhart, and he graciously drafted some amendments that addressed them. The Dash 4s we think are great. We're not concerned with schools like the schools that are about to follow me in testimony. We're concerned with folks who may not have the best intentions of districts. And districts need to be able to manage their enrollment and their enrollment policies. And so we think the Dash 4s do that. They permit district boards and local districts to manage what they need to manage, and we're in support of them.
Thank you.
Okay. I'm Leah Claypool. I'm from co-founder of Coburg Community Charter School and parents of third-generation Coburg students. And I just want to state that we've been working on this change for some time, and I really appreciate it getting to you now and the work that Representative Barnhart has done for us. I want to echo that this bill would give districts greater flexibility in helping their own charters to achieve the missions that the district chartered the schools for. We're required to work within the mission we were chartered for. Our mission is community immersion and place-based education, both of which are dependent heavily on being where we are and working with the businesses, community members, and organizations in our community. When families are no longer in attendance, it reduces that feeling of community. It causes you to go back and have to re-examine partnerships. And you also have kids that would be great additions or families being able to participate in the community events that happen in the school that are connect kids to our seniors, connect kids to our firemen, our farmers. But because of the way things are with the lottery system, we are attracting so many people from outside the district for reasons that I don't even know. Not outside our school district, but outside our former attendance boundary, that just statistically speaking, in a lottery, the Coburg area kids are just outnumbered. We will never fill our school with the kids in our town. We've never historically, that's why we were closed. We were small. There will always be room for students living outside the area. They're always welcome and encouraged. We just want to say that, you know, the people who put the effort in to keep our school and our community, it would be a blessing if they could continue to have that relationship with the school. So, and just to reaffirm, this is not a way for a group to come up with a new charter, plop it down in a neighborhood they like, and draw a circle around it. That's not what this does. It's a way to continue to serve underserved families when community schools are closed by larger districts. So, that's all.
Thank you.
I'm Darla Musin. I'm the executive director for Salvia Island Academy. Thank you for letting me testify today. As Leah said, I've been working on this since 2011 and 12 when we first became a charter. And our district takes a lot of pride that they didn't necessarily close, but they converted the school into a public charter. And they had a group of founding parents that were very willing to put in the time to make that process happen and have it be successful. And as Coburg, our mission is a place-based approach, and it's really challenging to think about having a place-based approach if the students who live in that place can't access it. And so the partnerships are really hard to maintain if none of the kids from the local farms can get into the school. And we've kind of run into that same thing where there's a populace of students who really benefit from hands-on, applied, experiential, place-based learning, and their parents are seeking out this option for them. And so in doing that, what happens is we have a lot of in-district applicants, and as Leah said, the sheer numbers, at some point, there's more in-district than there are island residents, and so at some point they would not be able to access the charter school. What that means for a lot of our students would be a tremendous travel burden. The island is like the size of Manhattan, so if you're at the very end of it, you have to ride the bus all the way back to the bridge and then turn around and come down Highway 30 and ride it virtually across the river back down into Scappoose, where you live. If they had like a boat or ferry, it'd be very quick, but they don't. And so for some of our kids, if they aren't able to access the public charter school that's near them, it could be an hour and a half ride. We had a situation come up with a kinder who was an ELL student, migrant student, and at first she was going to have to ride the bus to the high school and then transfer and then get on another bus to get to the K-3. So those are situations that we're really advocating for here is with the waiver process, and we have it in our charter contract. Our sponsoring school district has written us a letter of support every year that we have gone and applied to the state board for the geographical waiver. As Donovan said, it is a partnership with your school district, your sponsoring district, and they understand the need that's there. And there's no guarantee. So even with this law, Someone who lives on the island still has to apply just like everyone else. We have students that are island residents who are still on the wait list because we don't kick out a student to make room for that. And we have a cap of how many kids can attend the school. So we still have situations where students have to wait on the wait list. But this definitely reduces and tries to shrink that number down as best as we can. And then I would also just say, I know there's a lot of discussion, especially at the state school board level, about equity and access. And without the waiver, what we've found is that our large population of migrant students actually would not be able to access our school. And so in Scappoose, we have 36 ELL kids district-wide in all the schools, and six of them are at our school, so 20%. So I feel like it does allow and create diversity by having the waiver process approved currently. And so having the law in place would just cement that possibility and make it so that our resources as charter schools and the state board education resources aren't being dedicated to constantly reapplying for waivers, having them read, having a second, having a third. And so there's a lot of time and energy and conversation that goes in every time a waiver goes before the state board of education. And so I guess I think there's a lot of other things that we could both focus on. And so putting this into the law frees up those resources and those times for other more focused things for kids.
Thank you. Any questions for this group? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We'll be putting this on for a work session in the near future. I'm going to move some work sessions because I may get called out at any time to go do a testimony. So we'll move to some work sessions. So we're going to close the public hearing on 3313, and we're going to open a work session on House Bill 2399. We'll have a short explanation of what this bill does, and then Senator Lithicum.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, House Bill 2399 establishes the Condon Collection at the University of Oregon Museum of Natural and Cultural History as the official repository for paleontological material that may come into the possession of the state of Oregon. The bill assigns responsibility for material custody and safekeeping to the MNCH, prohibits interference with existing collections in the possession of any post-secondary institution, and allows individuals and private entities to gift paleontological collections directly to any institution.
Okay. Senator Lithicum.
Chair Roblin, I move HB 2399 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Lithicum moves House Bill 2399 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any opposition? So moved. Is there anyone that wants to carry?
Carry it.
Okay. Very good.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We're going to close the work session on House Bill 2399, and we're going to open a work session on House Bill 2220. And this is an opportunity. We're going to hear about another amendment we have to do shortly. So we'll hear from our administrator.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, House Bill 2220 modifies school district criteria for issuing high school diplomas to veterans by removing requirements that veterans who did not graduate from high school due to service in the armed forces and the requirement that veterans must have received GED certificate, post-secondary degree, or a minimum score on the Armed Services Vocational Aptitude Battery. The dash one amendment resolves a conflict with House Bill 2314, removing language from that bill relating to high school equivalency tests such as the general educational development exam.
Okay. Senator Lithicum.
Chair Roblin, I move the dash one amendment dated May 9th of 2018 to House Bill 2220.
So Senator Lithicum moves the dash one amendment dated May 9th, 2018, which is a conforming amendment just to make the bills conform. Is there any discussion? Any opposition? Seeing none, the amendment is moved. Senator Lithicum.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2220 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Lithicum moves House Bill 2220 as amended to the floor with the DuPass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any opposition? So moved. Who would like to carry? Anyone in particular? If not, I will do that. Okay, I'll take it. So we'll close the work session on House Bill 2220. We'll open a work session on House Bill 2229A.
Chair Roblin, I move House Bill 2299A to the 2229A to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Lithgow moves House Bill 2229A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any opposition? So moved, and we'll close. Who would like to carry this one?
I can do it.
Okay, thank you. Then we'll close the work session on 2229A, and we'll open a work session on House Bill 2648. It has to do with social workers. Do you want to do a short explanation of this bill since it's a little longer ago?
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, House Bill 2648 adds school social workers to the list of professions included in school-based systems for which school districts or education service districts may receive monies for decreasing rates of absenteeism. The bill declares an emergency effective on passage.
Okay, Senator Lithgow.
Chair, I would like to move House Bill 2648 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Lithgow moves House Bill 2648 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any opposition? Seeing none, so moved. Anyone wish to carry the bill? I will carry it. We're going to close the work session on 2648. We're going to open a work session on House Bill 2997. Short explanation.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, House Bill 2997 requires that half of collected fines for truancy violations are sent to school district or education service district, and the other half sent to the state, county, or municipal government, depending on which court entered the judgment.
Okay. So, Senator Lithgow.
Chair Roblin, I move House Bill 2997 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Lithgow moves House Bill 2997 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? We don't expect this to raise a lot of money, but I think it's a nice little statement about. Is there any opposition to the bill? Seeing none, so moved. Is there anyone that would like to carry the truancy money?
Do them all.
Thanks. Thank you, Senator Cruz. With that, we'll close our work session on 2997. We'll open a work session on House Bill 3106, and we'll have a short explanation.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, House Bill 3106 requires early learning hubs to convene annual meetings between representatives of the Oregon pre-kindergarten program and preschool program to coordinate the enrollment of eligible children and the provision of programs that best meet the needs of eligible children and their families. Requires early learning council to adopt rules to implement plans for changes to the federal Head Start program, and allows the ELC to adopt rules to provide half-day, full-day, or combined programs based on community assessments.
Okay. Senator Lithgow.
Chair Roblin, I move House Bill 3106 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Lithgow moves House Bill 3106 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any opposition? So moved.
I'll carry it.
Okay. Senator Gelser, thank you.
I like small children.
So we'll move back to our hearings, and we're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2312. With that, we'll have a short explanation.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, House Bill 2312 updates terms and references associated with the implementation of the Federal Workforce Innovation and Opportunity Act. The bill changes the name of the State Workforce Investment Board to the State Workforce Development Board. It directs the Higher Education Coordinating Commission to perform functions previously performed by the Office of Community Colleges and Workforce Development. Declares an emergency effective on passage.
So we're going to have Kyle Thomas come on up. And Kyle, in your testimony, be sure, because we have an issue on the floor at times if we don't understand why it's an emergency. So in your explanation, please explain to us why this is important to get done and why it is important to get done soon.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, Kyle Thomas, Director of Legislative and Policy Affairs for the Higher Education Coordinating Commission. I I'm not going to actually get into the explanation of the bill itself. The LPRO analyst description is complete. The entirety of the bill is technical and does the three things that were mentioned in her description. I appreciate the question, and it's actually a question I should have studied up on prior to coming up before you today. This concept was developed prior to me becoming an employee of the HEC, and so I'm actually, and with apology to the committee, going to have to research that question and provide you an answer at a later date. And that would conclude my testimony on this item.
pretty fast. Is there? That's what I'm going to do. Are there any questions for Kyle? Seeing no further questions, are there anybody else who would like to testify with regard to House Bill 2312? Seeing no further testimony, we will now close the public hearing on House Bill 2312.
And who's carrying?
Nobody.
That's right.
This is a public hearing.
Thank you. I've got carried away. You can kick the last one, too. And you can actually close the main because I've got to go testify. So
okay.
I'll leave you with this in good hands with this public hearing.
I will now open a public hearing on House Bill 2258. Let's see, do we have testimony? Mm-hmm. Or after a brief explanation, please let me see this public testimony sheet. Thank you.
Members of the committee, House Bill 2258 allows the Oregon Department of Education to give funding to statewide nonprofit organizations promoting leadership in career and technical education that relates to science, technology, engineering, and mathematics education and activities. The bill expands the scope of entities from school districts, education service districts, public schools, public charter schools, community colleges, and public universities to include statewide nonprofit organizations in any combination in order to qualify for departmental funding.
Thank you for the explanation. We have two witnesses that have registered, Emily Nazaroff and Brian Krieg.
Chair Lithicum, members of the committee, my name is Emily Nazaroff. I'm legislative coordinator with the Oregon Department of Education, and I'm here to speak in favor of House Bill 2258. So career and technical student organizations, what we call CTSOs, are student leadership organizations that are formally chartered by the State Board of Education. So these are the DECAs, FBLAs, FFAs. There is currently six that are formally chartered, and we're in the process of moving towards eight. So for several decades, the Oregon Legislature has provided support for these CTSOs through grant and aid through the Department of Education. A typical award is around $1,100, and there's about 250 awards each year that go directly to the school, the organization within the school. So in 2011, the Oregon Career Technical Education Student Leadership Foundation was created to make this process of administering these grants more efficient. So the foundation is a nonprofit organization, and the board is comprised of representatives from each of these CTSOs. So from 2011 to 2015, the Oregon Department of Education would enter into a contract with the foundation, and then the foundation would administer the grants out to these organizations in the individual schools. One of the big upsides was because it's the foundation doing the administration, the teachers that apply for the grants don't have to go through the state's electronic grant management system. In 2015, the Oregon Legislature passed House Bill 3072, which was the umbrella bill that covered a lot of CTE investments, including the investment in the CTSOs. That bill had a list of entities that are eligible to receive state funds, and it did not include nonprofits. So as a result, starting in 2015, we've not been able to use this foundation to administer the grants to the CTSOs. So the bill that's before you simply amends the language that was 3072 to allow us to contract with the foundation in order to administer these 250 small grants to these organizations in the schools. And that's it.
Very good. Next.
Vice Chair Lincecum, members of the committee, my name is Brian Krieg, and I represent the Sheet Metal and Air Conditioning Contractors Association, but in another role, I actually have been for the last 4 years the co-chair of the state CTE Revitalization Grant Committee, and was part of the group that put together House Bill 3072 last session. It was a bill that combined quite a few different bills. It was done at the very end of the session. We were the 10th to the last one that was voted out of the chambers, and this really was a typo glitch that should have been taken care of. We just did not notice it. The CTSO groups do a great service in our schools. You've heard about, like, the Future Farmers of America is a classic example of that, and how important they a role that they play in their communities and for the kids. And one of the things we kind of look at these CTSO groups at each school as, it's kind of a peer-to-peer marketing situation. Those kids who get excited about what they're doing, whether it be a shop class or the ag class or a health type occupational area, really communicate that with their other fellow students, and it's been a very big help for CTE over the decades. And we encourage you on behalf of the CTE and STEM Employers Coalition and others to support the bill and take care of this minor glitch that we had last session. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Does anyone have any questions regarding this? Seeing no questions, you're excused.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else who would like to testify with regard to House Bill 2258? With no other testimony, I will now close the public hearing on 2258. We have no other business, and this education committee is now adjourned.
Good job, Dennis.
Too much doing.
It looks like a 3-hour thing.